It's time for security now. Steve Gibson is here. Boy, do we have a packed show for you. There is a big Android malware going around. Steve will talk about that. Windows 11 is here, but is it ready for prime time? And then Steve breaks down step by step what went wrong at Facebook yesterday and what we can learn from it. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 839, recorded Tuesday, October 5th, 2021. Something went wrong. Security Now is brought to you by Bitwarden. Get the password manager that offers a robust and cost-effective solution that can drastically increase your chances of staying safe online. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. And by ESET. Nobody wants their organization to be patient zero in a cyber attack. Right now, ESET Protect Complete is 20% off, and you can try it before you buy. Get your free ESET business trial and an interactive demo at business.eset.com/twit. And by IT Pro TV. The world needs cybersecurity more than ever, along with qualified people to fill its roles. Get your cybersecurity certs with IT Pro TV. Visit itpro.tv/security now for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription when you use the code SN30 at checkout. It's time for Security Now. Check your BGP routing tables, kids. here he comes. He knows where he is thanks to DNS, Mr. Steve Gibson, the man in charge.
Yo, Leo.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
With you again for our, what is it? This is the first podcast of October.
Holy moly.
Of course, our listeners, you know, you'd have to be under a rock. Actually, there was one guy who was playing video games all day yesterday, and I got a tweet from him at the end of the day saying, oh, my God. You know, because, I mean, he suddenly resynchronized with the rest of the world and knew what or learned what we all knew was that Facebook's all their properties, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Oculus VR, and WhatsApp – all had a massive, well, comparatively, six-hour outage. So today's podcast gets its name from this wonderful page, which was being displayed yesterday. If you insisted on going to www.facebook.com, up came this page titled "Something Went Wrong," and so of course that's the title of today's podcast. Something went wrong. So we're going to explain what happened. It was fun because I was already working on today's podcast yesterday in the morning when this all began to happen. So I was able to tweet in real time and do some digging around and see what was happening. I think it's going to be a fun and interesting podcast for our listeners. But before we get there, we're going to take a look at this week's new pair of zero-day flaws from you-know-who. Google fixed them in Chrome. I forgot to try it this morning. I was unable to update to the latest one yesterday all day. And I thought maybe this has something to do, maybe it's weirdly tied in with Facebook, because I've never had an update server failure from Google, but I was unable to update Chrome yesterday. Anyway, because two more 0 days. So we'll talk about those. We're just going to note the arrival of Windows 11 with a little bit of a yawn, but also caution about one known flaw that it's already known to have. A pretty serious memory leak problem in Explorer. We're also going to look at some potential for global action against ransomware some possible movement, but don't hold your breath on this either, by the FCC to thwart SIM swapping and number transporting, or porting as it's abbreviated, attacks. We also examine a widespread Android Trojan, which is making its attackers far too much money, which unfortunately I think means we're going to be seeing more like this. And speaking of money, I know you mentioned it on MacBreak Weekly. There's a known flaw in Apple Pay when using a Visa card that's set in its transport mode. It's interestingly, both companies have been notified. Neither one wants to fix it. So it's still a problem. Anyway, we'll be talking about that. I've got a quick check-in on SpinRite. And then we're going to examine what exactly did go wrong at Facebook yesterday.
I was counting on that. I said, Steve will definitely cover
and
this.
Just sort of apropos of that, I've had a picture sitting in the queue for a long time, a fun picture of the week showing Earth's submarine cable network.
Oh, I've seen that. Yeah, very cool.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, and we'll talk about that on the other side.
Good. As always, not only a fascinating but informative and entertaining show ahead for you. A must-listen, I would say, this week. Steve, the show is brought to you by Bitwarden, which is my favorite password manager these days. Open source, very affordable. In fact, there's a free tier to Bitwarden. It's the only, I think, open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home and at work or on the go. Is trusted by millions. I converted fully to Bitwarden at the beginning of the year, and no looking back. It's incredible. If you want to use it in business, highly recommend it. Empower your employees to follow password management best practices. They won't unless you, quote, empower them, encourage them, demand it of them. But Bitwarden makes it easy. Bitwarden stores your credentials, and the nice thing is, in fact, if you want to use the Bitwarden for business, what you do is each employee sets up their personal Bitwarden vault, and then you add their vault to the organizational vault, so they get the best of both worlds, credentials in and completely separate, completely discreet, completely secure in their both their personal and their business. And man, is it customizable. When you go to the enterprise model with Bitwarden, you've got policies you can adapt in every possible area. I strongly encourage, for instance, you encourage or demand two-factor minimum password length, things like that. They have nice features, too. They're always adding great stuff. Bitwarden Send, they just added that earlier this year, a fully encrypted method to transmit sensitive information, text, files, whatever, to anyone. If you are in a business where you have private data, maybe you do tax preparation or you're a physician, you really want to know about Bitwarden Send. Team members, of course, anybody uses Bitwarden can generate unique, secure passwords for every site. And it's enterprise-grade security, fully compliant with GDPR, CCPA, the California Privacy Act, HIPAA for medical, SOC 2 compliant. And that end-to-end encrypted vault also helps mitigate phishing attacks by storing passwords and warning you if you're, you know, on a site that you don't expect to be on. Great new tools for MSPs, by the way. If you are, I'm always a fan of enterprise products that MSPs can use, managed service providers can use, because they are the front line. We use one. That's Russell. But they're the front line of defense on many small businesses. Bitwarden's new provider portal lets MSPs easily manage client password management services with multiple accounts, but it's all in one place, which is fantastic. You get simple access to each separate organization. Plus, there are two new user types allowing for delegation of management and to kind of help you clearly differentiate between the service provider and client users. And business plans are really affordable with Bitwarden. As I said, there's a free tier, free forever, for personal use. Their Teams organization option is $3 a month per user. That lets you share private data securely with coworkers or with the department or even with the entire organization. It's very granular. For enterprises, use Bitwarden's enterprise organization plan. That's just $5 a month per user. And there is even a free organization plan, maybe a good way to get your started, get your toe wet, for two users. So the two users can store and share secure passwords. And because Bitwarden is absolutely committed to the idea that everyone should have access to basic password security tools, the basic free account is free forever for an unlimited number of passwords. And, you know, I liked it so much, I immediately upgraded $1 a month to the premium account because I wanted to support them. I think they're really a good company doing a great product. If you're looking for secure password storage for the family, they've got that too. There's a family plan. 6 users, premium features, $333 a month. If you are in some plans, not all plans, you can store the cloud on your own server. If you're really paranoid and you don't want to have a central server, I use Bitwarden's cloud because I feel like they're absolutely better at securing their server than I am. There's a Bitwarden Vault health report that'll help you monitor and manage security vulnerabilities. That's really nice in a business because you can identify exposed, reused, weak, or potentially compromised passwords, as well as any active items in your vault with inactive two-factor. That's really handy. So I'm basically telling you about the best password manager out there, Bitwarden. Go to bitwarden.com/twit. You can get started right now with a free Teams or Enterprise trial, or try it free across all devices as an individual user. And if you're going to do that, please still use bitwarden.com/twit. Let them know you saw it here. I want to keep them around for a long time. bitwarden.com/twit. Thank you, Bitwarden, for supporting our security and for security now. Now, Steve, shall we look at the picture of the week?
This diagram really is fascinating.
You've been looking at it the whole time, haven't you? You're funny.
I have. It's really interesting. I mean, when it's not something you normally think about, but you know, over land, we have fibers running around all over the place. But you know, how do you get across the Atlantic or across the Pacific, or actually, based on this chart, even like down the coast of Africa?
The Bering Strait. Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, now it's gotten – bandwidth is such a thing that Google and Facebook are laying their own cables like that they will control. So this isn't just like, you know, like what originally it was so expensive that you'd put together, multi-party ownership, in order to share the cost. But with Google and Facebook being as large as they are, you know, there's like some ship heading off with a big roll of fiber optic cable on its back, you know, slowly unspooling. And when you think about it, it's like there's like, you know, like nothing to contain a cable, right? A submarine cable. It's just rolls out the back of the ship and lays on the ground. And, you know, best of luck. And, of course, it turns out that maintenance is a problem, that there are things that are cutting them. Earthquakes are a problem. Anchors of other ships, you know, you drop anchor and when you pull it up, you drag a cable up with you and go, whoops, and, you know, slip it off the anchor and hope, and then quickly move your ship so that, you know, you hope that you didn't cut the cable and create problems. So anyway, this chart in the show notes is the Earth's submarine cable network, which, you know, the predominant traffic is, from the U.S., both coasts of the U.S., over to their respective other sides on the other side of the Pacific and the Atlantic, in order to connect all of this together. So we're able to talk to each other and annoy each other for like nothing anymore.
Our bits are on these cables right now.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. That is really just something. So yeah. It's just sort of a cool thing. In fact, look at that little thing down there. It looks like it's a little blip, it looks like it's like linking opposite sides of Texas or something. It's like, what is that down there in the Gulf, in our Gulf? It's like, you know, like little bloop.
That's
it's
a
like
funny one, isn't it?
Cheaper to go by sea than by land, yeah. Apparently.
Houston to New Orleans or something. That's
sort of
weird.
Yeah. Sort of a little jumper cable.
That's, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, just very cool. Okay. So another two in the wild, true 0 days found and fixed in Chrome. Chrome. In fact, let me right now while I'm here, because it'll take no time. I'm going to fire up Chrome, and I just fired up PaintShop Pro by mistake. I pressed the wrong icon.
So easy to do. I understand.
yes, PSP6 still my go-to. Let's see. So help about Google Chrome. I'm still getting an error. An error occurred while checking for updates. Update check failed to start. Error code 30X8004002 system level. And then it says learn more. And when you click on that, as I did and as I have been recently, it's taking a while to load. Ooh, I wonder if a lot of people are clicking on that. Anyway, what it tells you is that errors 3 and 11 are upgrade server is not found, and I'm not even getting that page up now. That's interesting. Everything else is working fine. Anyway, their most recent update late last week resolved yet another pair of authentic zero-day vulnerabilities, which were found being exploited in the wild, thus authentic zero-day vulnerabilities and not let's just call everything a zero-day. For those keeping score at home, this brings us to 14 so far this year as we finish with month 9 and start into month 10. And as I said, when I went to Chrome to ask it to update itself, because I always seem to have to give it a little nudge. And what do you got there, Leo?
94, you're showing it says.
94. And I've got in my notes.
This is on the Mac, of course.
But at the end, is that .71 or .61?
.71.
Okay, you got the latest. I'm stuck on 6.1, and I don't seem to be able, at two locations, to be able to get Chrome to update itself to 7.1.
Yeah. Huh.
Interesting. Or you just slipped in and got lucky. Maybe there, yeah. You know, because, I mean, even now, it's like saying, can't get there. Anyway, so issues were CVE 2021-37975 and 976, they were found and, as Google does, immediately put to rest. They were fixed by a total of 4 patches surrounding a use after free flaw in the VB JavaScript and WebAssembly engine, as well as an information leak from Chrome's core. The discovery and report of the 975 flaw was credited to an anonymous researcher, so we don't know who, some good person. But 976 was found by the same researcher within Google's own tag team, who also discovered the actively exploited use after free flaw in Chrome's Portals API that we talked about last week. You know, eventually for me and for whoever else might be having a problem, I'll check Twitter when we do our next sponsor break, Leo, and see if other reports are of a problem. But I'm right now still stuck at .61, which is where we were with last week's podcast, trying to get to .71. So anyway, it's not an emergency. These are going to be probably targeted attacks. It is the case. We know that once they become public, they do tend to get used more quickly because now they have a window of opportunity, which is not for me closing as quickly as it should be. But anyway, Google's on it. And, you know, I was thinking about this. At what point do we start saying this is an awful lot of zero-day vulnerabilities? I think Google probably takes a bit more heat over these than they deserve, since whereas this does bring the total to 14 zero-day vulnerabilities so far this year, Microsoft fixes scores of such problems every month. And even then, only after they decide to stop ignoring them for, you know, many months beforehand. So I still think Google is doing the right thing, and I'm glad that we're down essentially to two browsers, right? We got Firefox and we have Chromium, and, you know, Chromium and its all of its users. So good. Windows 11. Yesterday, thanks to a tweet from Paul Thurrott, we have the official Windows 11 download page. So since I was in a tweeting mode while I was following all of this interesting Facebook adventure, I said, anyone seeking additional pain can now obtained the official Windows 11 directly from Microsoft. Then I said, in parentheses, I would call it the final Windows 11, but who are we kidding? So, yeah, this notion of a final Windows, well, we've been disabused of that completely thanks to the Windows 10 adventure. We never did have a final Windows 10, and now we definitively know that they say they never intended Windows 10 to be the last Windows ever. So every few years, I assume, Microsoft will find something new to do to the UI that allows them to increment Windows' major version number and to enforce some new random and arbitrary restriction on which machines it will run on. And because I'm a pragmatist, I'm pretty sure that Microsoft will never lose me as a user. For me, the things I need to do, Windows is far more practical than any of the alternatives, though I certainly acknowledge that the alternatives are getting a lot better. But still, Microsoft has and they continue to needlessly discard bits and pieces of my respect for no good reason. I'm just unimpressed with the way they're conducting themselves. You know, the fact that I have to actually remove Candy Crush Soda Saga from my start machine, I'm on my start menu. Are you kidding me? Like, whoa. Anyway, to make finding Windows 11 easy, I created the shortest, practical, and easy to remember grc.sc shortcut possible. It's just, of course, 11. So grc.sc/11, and that will bounce you to Microsoft's official, it's all there now for everybody who wants it, software download Windows 11 page. And, you can download, you can get the ISO, you can download it onto a ready-to-install USB. I mean, they've got that much worked out at least, so yay for that. And speaking of Windows 11, we have a known memory leak in Windows Explorer for Windows 11. PC Gamer notes that, quote, Windows 11 will soon be rolling out, and then rhetorically asks, but will File Explorer keep chomping through your RAM? And at least in what they believe they have, it will. It seems that among the many known new bugs which Windows 11 is introducing is a big new memory leak in Windows File Explorer. So PC Gamer informs us that, quote, the Windows 11 File Explorer memory leak bug, which surfaced a couple of months ago thanks to the keen eyes of one Windows 11 Insider preview user, is outlined in a post by user GyroHand269 on the Windows 11 subreddit. They note that with each instance of Windows File Explorer opened, the RAM usage stacks and doesn't disperse upon exiting. The post was met with thousands of upvotes from those experiencing the same thing, and plenty of comments from users who were able to replicate the issue. So they wrote, we're currently running version 22,000.194. They say, which we believe, and I do too, is the release version on our test bench, they wrote. And this author said, and I was able to reliably replicate the bug several times. And no, the RAM usage still hasn't freed up even after about half an hour of waiting. They wrote, if you want to check this is a problem for your own Windows 11 version, open Task Manager now and sort your processes by highest memory usage. Then they wrote, spam the Win plus E, key combination. He said, you'll notice Explorer rise up the list pretty fast. And once you've closed them all, keep an eye out to see if the memory frees up. There doesn't seem to be an official acknowledgement of the issue anywhere, let alone news of a coming fix, which, again, they've known about it for months. It's been, you know, not acknowledged by Microsoft, but a lot of noise has been made. Yet they're shipping it anyway because we'll fix it in post. Thankfully, it's been logged in the feedback hub. So if you could replicate it, this PC Gamer site, I have the link in the show notes, suggests to pile on so Microsoft will be made aware that this is a wide-ranging issue.
There are so many, though. I wouldn't count on getting bumped to the top of the list.
I know.
Paul thinks it's way too early, as you said.
Yes. In fact, it was interesting because I heard him, yes,
on the
basically
show he said
echoing
that. Yeah,
me.
Yeah.
Yes. On last Wednesday's Window Weekly, he said, come on, really? Like, this is not even beginning to be ready.
Yeah.
But the show must go on. Hey, I figure once the corners have been rounded, it's like, well.
It's done.
It's like they've given up, right? They've just like, well,
it's
you know.
Enough.
We're never going to get this right. We're never going to actually finish this. So let's just push out a stream of these. Now we'll just call 11 rather than 10.
It is interesting, though, that we are now accustomed to the notion that every bit of software is constantly updated, right? There's no longer this sense that anything's done. We know it's all going to be updated forever. Until they stop, until they give up.
Well, we know the sole voice in the wilderness.
Yes. Oh, yeah. You have one program. Yeah. Okay. All right. No bugs in your software.
Well, and when it's done, somebody over in the spinrite.dev news group the other day suggested, pointed me to some fancy automated system for like automatically checking for patches and downloading them and integrating them in software that had already been shipped. I mean, like proposing that I use that. And I said,
Why?
You know, SpinRite 6 hasn't changed since 04. The DNS benchmark hasn't changed since I shipped it. Or it's like there was a couple little things shortly after launch. But then, you know, it's fine. Never 10? Well, not since 10. Squirrel never had a bug. I didn't touch it since I finished it. So, yeah. I do have a DNS-based means for all the software moving forward to ping a pseudo server that I run to check to see if anything might have changed. All's quiet on that front.
Although that's prudent to put that in if you had to do a patch, right?
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Makes sense to have it.
Yeah.
Yep. Because, of course, the moment you don't, well, actually not even then, but still. But Leo, I take your point. Yes, all other software is just a moving target.
Right.
It's like, well, you know, and I have, and really, I have the news group gang to thank because I'm getting ready to launch the next release, and they will happily pound on it, and we'll find some obscure stuff where, you know, if you touch your nose when you're standing on your right foot and spin around three times and hit enter while coughing, then sure enough, it's a different shade of green on the screen or something. But you know, though, I would rather fix it now than fix it later. So there's some news, kind of, on the ransomware and cyber warfare front. And what's sad is even that we have a term, cyber warfare. Okay, the U.S. announced last Friday that the administration will be conducting a series of online virtual meetings with representatives from 30 countries, because after all, they're online and virtual. So let's just all get ourselves a little Zoom window and we're going to do this. Or maybe we're going to have, you know, somebody on that stage that we saw, right? Like Biden was doing a bunch of, I don't know what they were, but, you know, lots of little windows and everybody was talking at once. Anyway, this will include NATO allies and G7 partners on the topic of cybercrime, with an explicit focus on ransomware and the concomitant abuse of cryptocurrency. In their press release on the topic, the White House said, quote, "This month, the United States will bring together 30 countries to accelerate our cooperation in combating cybercrime, improving law enforcement collaboration, stemming the illicit use of cryptocurrency, and engaging on these issues diplomatically. And actually, I didn't make it into the show notes, but I did see in passing that the UK has budgeted a bunch of money. I had to do a double take. And apparently it involves proactive cyber warfare. It's like, ooh, the tip of the spear. So, okay, or the tip of the packet, at least. According to the release, additional topics to be discussed will include 5G technology, supply chain attacks, quantum computing. I'd love to be a fly on the wall for that discussion with 30 countries, and AI. So I guess, you know, you poke the bear enough and it rouses. As we know, last May was the attack against Colonial Pipeline, which resulted in fuel shortages across the U.S. East Coast. The next month, in June, the attack on JBS Foods disturbed the supply of meat across the U.S. You know, don't mess with the bear's meat supply. And then in July, the massive series of attacks, which leveraged flaws in Kaseya's IT management servers, which, as we well know, created disruptions at hundreds of companies across the U.S. and more than 1,500 globally. So we're told that President Biden first raised the issue of ransomware attacks carried out from within Russia's borders with Putin during a face-to-face meeting last June, and that he again raised the issue in a phone call in early July. Presumably, he's supposed to have a great relationship with Putin. So saying, look, crack down on gangs operating in Russia. You're really pissing us off over here. And now we know that if that was done, what actually transpired remains unknown, but it apparently didn't last very long since multiple attacks resumed last month. And this did lead the FBI to formally conclude that they saw, quote, no indication, unquote, that Russian officials had actually taken any effort to crack down on these groups. You know, as we talked about, when these attacks resumed, it looked like maybe they'd taken a vacation and they said, you know, everybody needs a little time off. We're back. Wonderful. So there are a number of big, significant, and very interesting macro trends taking shape. You know, what governments ultimately decide to do about encryption that they cannot crack is another one. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this all plays out. We actually do appear to be entering a period of true internation economic cyber warfare. And that idea, as I said, still startles and unsettles me. I don't want it to be true, but it seems to be becoming so. On the topic of thwarting swapping attacks, as we know, I titled our August 31st podcast, Life Hanging by a Pin. And I know from the much greater than average level of feedback I received that my painting a clear picture of just how vulnerable we would typically be if our smartphone number were to fall into the hands of an attacker, that a greater awareness of the trouble did hit home with our listeners. So I was interested to see, and I was initially hopeful, and I wanted all of our listeners to know that at least some of the U.S. bureaucracy is awake to this threat and is beginning to move on it. The bad news is that the specific arm of the U.S. bureaucracy is the FCC. Last Thursday, the FCC, of course, our Federal Communications Commission, announced its plans to introduce new rules for U.S. mobile carriers to govern any changes made to their subscribers' telephone numbers in an attempt to address the growing problem of SIM swapping and port out fraud attacks. Okay, that sounds great, right? Of course, as we know, these attacks surround mobile carriers' failure to correctly verify the requesting party's identity when that party requests either that their service be transferred to a new SIM card or to an account at another mobile operator. That podcast, number 834, painted a very clear and depressing picture of just how much devastation could result. The U.S. Justice Department has charged many individuals over the past few years with theft enabled by SIM swapping and port-out fraud. And some of the victims of these thefts have, understandably, brought lawsuits against their mobile carriers in an attempt to recover their monetary losses. Many of those lawsuits are still working their way through the U.S.'s delay-prone legal system, so no conclusions to those yet. In response to the problems, some U.S. carriers have introduced additional verification measures to, you know, attempt to limit this sort of fraud. But the SIM swapping gangs have also upped their game. Some groups have started bribing carrier employees, or they've used vulnerabilities they've identified in the carrier's networked back-end systems to perform the attacks for them, thus skipping the need to have any direct contact and trick the carrier's front-end support staff. In its press release Thursday, the FCC announced that in response to having received, quote, numerous complaints from customers, I'll bet, that it's initiating a, quote, formal rulemaking process, unquote, by issuing a, quote, notice of proposed rulemaking. Okay. These are the same people who said they were going to outlaw and prevent telephone spam. So I think this means that it's still going to be up to us to protect ourselves. An FCC spokesperson told The Record, who reported on this issue, that, quote, the FCC's rulemaking process generally starts with a notice of proposed rulemaking that asks questions and makes proposals. We then have a period during which we take public comments, generally made through our electronic comment filing system,
which, as now, we know in the past, has been somewhat unreliable.
Just to remind everyone, that's the ineptly designed system that was brutally spammed during their net neutrality request for comments period, you know, during which more people than exist on planet Earth weighed in with their opinion about net neutrality. Anyway, they concluded, quote, we review comments before taking any next steps. Because, oh goodness, we would not want the FCC to act prematurely on our behalf of securing our SIMs and require them to be, you know, more security before allowing them to be moved. So, you know, although I wrote about the fact that some of the U.S. bureaucracy is awake to this threat and is becoming, it's beginning to move on it, unfortunately, that bureaucracy is the FCC. So, you know, and I have a friend who's
really wants to talk to you. Yes.
He's having his home repiped. And that's quite an adventure. So I'm getting, you know, pipe by pipe updates.
They put in the drain pipe now. Wow.
Yeah. His house was built in 1984, and he's beginning to have pinhole leaks.
Oh.
Apparently as a consequence of Southern California water, which, by the way, is why I'm on the other side of a quad filter reverse osmosis filter. Yeah. It is undrinkable down here in Southern California.
Yeah. Well,
really,
you steal
remember
it from
when,
us.
When we
poison
up,
it before we send it to you.
Yeah. Remember when we were growing up, you'd have the hose on on a hot Saturday afternoon.
You drink from that?
With this water. You just,
so
just
good.
Slurp. Oh,
so
my
good.
God. It was.
Well, you were, what but happened? See, you were up here in Northern California. The water was better in San Mateo back in those days. San Francisco has very pristine water.
Even now you can drink it?
Yeah, it's from the Hetch Hetchy. So it's, it's good. I'm not sure where LA gets its water, but I don't. I'm not surprised it's not good.
It comes out of the sewer system, I think.
Actually,
you don't want to be getting it out of the ocean, Lord knows.
No.
Because we've got a big oil spill down here.
Yeah, right off the coast, right where you are. Yeah.
And don't I remember, are you using well water?
We have a well. And we, like you, have a significant amount of filtration.
Oh.
We have softening because there's a lot of iron in it. And then it goes from the softening. And the drinking water specifically is reverse osmosis and charcoal filtered. And Yep. It's delicious, though. By the time it's done, man, that's good. It's kind of like getting the hose in your backyard out of the backyard. All right. We're going to take a break, I think. Yes.
Yes, we are.
And then we will talk about a new Android Trojan.
Ooh.
And, of course, Leo, the Facebook story coming up.
You probably haven't scrolled ahead, but I just to be a little more punchy, I wanted to list the number of apps which were found with that Trojan. So just prepare yourself.
Oh, it's a long list. I shall scroll through them. Holy cow. Wow. Whew. Our show today brought to you – I love talking about security because I want everybody to be more secure. In fact, I want us to be more secure, always talking to Russell, our IT guy, and saying, are we safe? Are we safe? Are we safe? And he always says, yes, we are. I finally found out the reason we're safe is because we use ESET. Actually, we use a whole lot of stuff. A good security strategy is layered. But ESET is really a great place for us to kind of plant our stake in the sand and say, you shall not pass. ESET are the global leaders in cybersecurity research and innovations. We've been using them at TWIT for years. I mean, probably more than a decade. One of the reasons we choose them today is, of course, because of ransomware protection. That wasn't a problem when we started, but it's become one. And, of course, the nice thing about having a good provider like ESET is they keep up to date with the latest threats. This month is, I don't know if you knew this, Steve, Cybersecurity Awareness Month. So it's a good month to be listening to this show. So let's talk a little bit about ransomware and how it's changing how you think about security. Not only is ransomware spreading fast, but it is much more sophisticated. I don't know if you've noticed that. And that's because there's a lot of money in it. I know you've noticed that. And the folks, the cyber criminals who create this are really incentivized to bring, to bring new strains along, new techniques, to find new ways of getting into your system. Who was it? It was a company I just saw admitted that they had hackers in their network for like forever, for a really long time. So we use ESET's Dynamic Threat Defense, EDTD, EDTD. It uses a cloud. This is such a clever idea. Cloud-based sandboxing technology. This way they can detect and isolate never-before-seen viruses. So what happens is it sees something that looks suspicious, and EDTD handles a wide range of files, documents, scripts. It works on installers. It's identifying and isolating, as soon as it sees it, in your email, for instance, in your attachments, suspicious stuff. It says, well, that's an executable. Let's isolate it. They then run it up in the cloud in a safe sandboxed environment that lets them watch in great depth what's going on. Deep inspection and code analysis. Using machine learning, in-memory analysis, AI, EDTD enables behavior-based detection, which means that they can allow or block a file, and they do it fast, in minutes. It's a really clever way of doing it, and you need that kind of speed, but it's not putting demands on your system because it's all... it's all in the cloud. It says some endpoint detection can't accomplish. Look, you don't want to be patient zero in a cyber attack. Oh, great news. Yeah, sure, everything's down, but it's the first time this one's ever happened. Oh, that's nice. If you're looking for world-class ransomware protection, you're going to want something really good. ESET Dynamic Threat Defense. We use it. And it's part of ESET's Protect Complete bundle, including endpoint security, full disk encryption. Yeah, I think that's nice. Advanced security for Microsoft 365, because God knows they need it. Right now, ESET Protect Complete is 20% off, and you can try it before you buy it. Get your free ESET business trial, an interactive demo. See how this whole thing works. I think you'll be really impressed. I know I was. business.eset.com/twit. And again, 20% off ESET Protect Complete. But this is a limited time offer, so don't wait. Go to business.eset.com/twit. Take a look. I think you'll be impressed. And we thank him so much for supporting Steve's ongoing mission to protect us all on Security Now. Malware on the Android again.
Yeah. I don't talk about Android a lot because, well, this is a lot to talk about. Zimperium, research group that we've often referred to, recently revealed their research into one of the best named Android malware campaigns I've seen in a long time. So it's a Trojan. So we have a horse, and it signs its victims up to high cost services to reap the rewards. So they named it Grift Horse.
I get it.
It's just
don't
perfect.
Look it in the mouth.
Don't look that Grift Horse in the mouth. That's right. So, but what caught my eye was the tremendous number of apps, the tremendous effort that had gone into the creation of Grift Horse's, count them, 139 individually created and infected with a Trojan app. Some of them are like do what they say they're going to do. Some of them don't do anything. But there's just a ton of them. And in fact, a total infection base.
Now, some of these were not created by the virus, like Forza H or Truecaller. So there must be a library they're using or something.
Right.
Because
right.
Some of these are legit apps. That's what's really scary. These are not
exactly,
you know, just throwaway apps.
Right. And like Handy Translator Pro, there was a million downloads of that.
Oh, this is bad.
So Zimperium explains, they said, the threat actors have exerted substantial effort to maximize their presence in the Android ecosystem through a large number of applications, developer accounts, and domains. The Zimperium Z-Lab researchers have noticed the technique of abusing cross-platform development frameworks to stay undetected has been on the rise, making it more difficult for legacy mobile AV providers to detect and protect their customers. The timeline of the threat group dates back to November 2020, suggesting that their patience and persistence will probably not come to an end with the closing down of this one campaign. The threat to Android users will always be present, considering the innovative approaches used by malicious actors to infect the victims. They finished, the numerical stats reveal that more than 10 million Android users fell victim to this campaign globally, suffering financial losses, while the threat group grew wealthier and motivated with time. And while the victims struggled to get their money back, which is often not possible, as we'll see in a second, the cyber criminals made off with millions, actually hundreds of millions of euros through this technically novel and effective Trojan campaign. So just to give people, you know, instead of saying, oh, yeah, there's a lot of them, I grabbed the list and formatted it for the show notes. I mean, it's just like it's a who's who. And just they estimate as many as 17,345,450 downloads spread across this 390 Android apps. So they summed up their position on this by writing, these mobile applications pose a threat to all Android devices, by functioning as a Trojan that subscribes unsuspecting users to paid services, charging a premium amounting to around 36 euros per month, which is about $42. The campaign has targeted millions of users from over 70 countries by serving selective malicious pages to users based on the geolocation of their IP address with the local language. This social engineering trick, they write, is exceptionally successful, considering users might feel more comfortable sharing information to a website in their local language. Upon infection, the victim is bombarded with alerts on the screen, letting them know they had won a prize and needed to claim it immediately. These pop-ups appear no less than 5 times per hour until the application user successfully accepts the offer, just to shut it up. Upon accepting the invitation for the prize, the malware redirects the victim to a geo-specific web page where they are asked to submit their phone numbers for verification. But in reality, they're submitting their phone number to a premium SMS service that would start charging their phone bill over 30 euros per month. The victim does not immediately notice the impact of the theft, and the likelihood of it continuing for months before detection is high, with little to no recourse to get one's money back. These cyber criminals took great care not to get caught by malware researchers by avoiding hard-coding URLs or reusing the same domains and filtering slash serving the malicious payload based on the originating IP address's geolocation. This method allowed the attackers to target different countries in different ways. This check on the server side evades dynamic analysis, checking for network communication and behavior. Overall, Grifthorse, Android Trojan, takes advantage of small screens, local trust, and misinformation to trick users into downloading and installing these Trojans, as well as frustration or curiosity when finally accepting the fake free prize spammed into their notification screens. So I wanted to put this particular campaign on our listeners' radar because just as when we first talked about ransomware many years ago, and I commented then that it felt to me as though it was really going to become a problem in the future, this feels the same way. The trouble is that the attackers behind this were known to be netting several $1 million per month. And this creates a lot of motivation. And many of the new facets of this approach have been proven to be surprisingly successful now. So it's not like they tried it and it didn't work. They tried it and it did work. And unlike a single ransomware attack where, you know, or which inherently creates a single point of failure for the attacker if their victim chooses not to comply, you know, even in the face of all the threats and extortion and threats to disclose information and everything. In this model, the individual damages in this attack are small. They're incremental and widely dispersed across 70 countries and 10 million individuals in many languages. So they individually slip under the radar by siphoning a small cash flow from many millions of individuals who are end users. And in the process, they create what amounts to a stable cash flow of illicit funds for the bad guys. This Grifthorse campaign not only managed to fly under the radar and to avoid AV detection for many months, like starting back in November and it just now came to light, it likely surpassed hundreds of millions of dollars in total amount plundered from its victims until Zimperium responsibly notified Google of their discovery, and Google immediately purged those identified apps from the Play Store. But even so, those apps continue to be available on untrusted third-party app repositories, which again, of course, underscores for us the risks associated with sideloading arbitrary apps from untrusted sources. So I'm afraid that we can expect to see more of this style of attack in the future, probably on the Android platform, since it's where it makes the most sense. Over on the Apple side, there's a problem that's been identified with
just
Apple
in case
Pay.
You Apple people feel smug and safe.
That's right. Before you go, huh.
So there.
We got a problem with Apple Pay and Visa. And disturbingly, both companies have been informed, but neither have chosen to fix the problem because they're arguing over whose fault it is, even though either one of them could mitigate the trouble at their end. So a handful of researchers at the University of Birmingham and the University of Surrey, both in the UK, have written up their research in a paper which will participate in the 2022 – wow, Leo, that's coming up before we know it – 2022 IEEE Symposium on Security and Privacy. Okay, now their paper's abstract suggests that maybe they've been spending a little too much time in the lab. They should get out more. They explain rather densely, quote, relay attackers, meaning relay attackers, can forward messages between a contactless EMV bank card and a shop reader, making it possible to wirelessly pickpocket money. To protect against this, Apple Pay requires a user's fingerprint or face ID to authorize payments, while MasterCard and Visa have proposed protocols to stop such relay attacks. We investigate transport payment modes and find that we can build on relaying to bypass the Apple Pay lock screen and illicitly pay from a locked iPhone to an EMV reader for any amount without user authorization. Gulp. We show that Visa's proposed relay countermeasure can be bypassed using rooted smartphones. We analyze MasterCard's relay protection and show that its timing bounds could be more reliably imposed at the lower protocol level rather than at the EMV protocol level. With these insights, we propose a new relay resistance protocol. They call it the L1RP for EMV. We use the Tamarin Prover. That's something we talked about back when we were talking about all of this, the idea of doing robust proof using a formal proof technology. That's this Tamarin Prover, to model mobile phone payments with and without user authentication and in different payment modes. We formally verify solutions to our attack suggested by Apple and Visa and used by Samsung, and we verify that our proposed protocol provides protection. Oh, there we go. Proposed protocol provides protection from relay attacks. Okay, so what does this mean practically? Elsewhere, they make this more clear, explaining contactless Europay, MasterCard, and Visa, thus EMV, Europay, MasterCard, Visa, EMV payments, they say, are a fast and easy way to make payments that are increasingly becoming a standard way to pay. However, if payments can be made with no user input, This increases the attack surface for adversaries and especially for relay attackers who can ferry messages between cards and readers without the owner's knowledge, thus enabling fraudulent payments. Payments via smartphone apps generally have to be confirmed by a user via a fingerprint, a PIN code, or a Face ID. This makes relay attacks less of a threat. However, Apple Pay introduced the Express Transit / Travel feature in May of 2019, which allows Apple Pay to be used at a transport ticketing barrier station without unlocking the phone for usability convenience. We show that this feature can be leveraged to bypass the Apple Pay lock screen and illicitly pay from a locked iPhone using a Visa card to any EMV reader for any amount without user authorization. Furthermore, Visa has proposed a protocol to stop such relay attacks for cards. We show that Visa's proposed relay countermeasure can be bypassed using a pair of NFC-enabled Android smartphones, one of which is rooted. Okay, so here's the bottom line. The Apple Pay lock screen can be bypassed for any iPhone with a Visa card set up in transit mode. The contactless limit can be bypassed, allowing unlimited amount EMV contactless transactions originating from that locked iPhone. An attacker only needs a remote access, a powered on iPhone, stolen in a handbag or in a pocket. It does not need to be unlocked. The transactions can also be relayed from an iPhone inside someone's handbag or pocket, as I said, without their knowledge, and the attacker needs no assistance from the merchant. So no clicks anywhere. Back-end fraud detection checks have not stopped any of their test payments. They did a 1,000 euro transaction. No red flags, no alarms. It went through. So just to be clear, this attack is made possible by a combination of flaws in both Apple Pay and in Visa's system. It does not, for instance, affect MasterCard on Apple Pay or Visa on Samsung. You got to have Apple Pay and Visa both. Their research provides formal modeling that shows that either Apple or Visa could mitigate this attack on their own. As I noted above, both companies have been informed months ago, yet neither have fixed their system. So the vulnerability remains live and workable today. The researchers recommend that all iPhone users check that they do not have a Visa card set up in transit mode, and if they do, it would need to be disabled to prevent this attack from succeeding against that phone and that card. So it's not that it's not going to happen, but it could, right? I mean, so it seems, like I don't use my iPhone. I do have a Visa card. Yeah, I do.
And I'm sure you don't have transit mode turned on because there's no subways in Irvine.
Exactly.
Or maybe
exactly.
You take the bus. Do you take the bus, Steve?
No.
No, I don't see you in a bus. on your way to Starbucks.
Hopefully, Apple will get some flack now that this research is public and they'll fix this.
They're blaming Visa, though. They say, well, it's not our problem. It's a bug in Visa stuff.
And here we have another instance of Apple only fixing something when someone makes them.
Yeah.
And even then, it's like saying, no, pointing the finger at them. The researchers make it clear Apple could fix this if they chose. But no. And that's disappointing.
Yeah.
just a quick update on Foundation. You and I chatted about it briefly before we began recording, Leo. In my opinion, no improvement after the third show, the third episode. It's just not fun. You know, it's not exciting. It's slow and heavy and boring. And, you know, so I'm hoping that when hostile aliens invade the Earth this Friday on Apple's new series, Invasion, which begins on Friday, that will provide some much needed sci-fi excitement, because there's no excitement coming from Foundation. Wow.
Yeah. Oh, that's too bad. I hope the Invasion will be good too.
And I heard you ask Alex what he imagined this cost them to produce.
Did you hear?
Yeah. Tens of millions of dollars for an episode. So
he said 50.
Wow.
He said 50, which is like, you know, movie money, $50 million an hour. That's how much I can't believe it'd be that much, but maybe it is. $15 million was the morning show, and that didn't have aliens. So not that aliens are necessarily more expensive, just a little rubber makeup. And you pretty much.
I was trying to. Yeah.
They didn't have spaceships. Now, they're expensive.
Matt Copit tweeted to me, regarding the sound quality on Foundation, I noticed the same thing with muddled dialogue and found that disabling Dolby Atmos in my Apple TV's audio settings improved things dramatically. Your mileage may vary, but feel free to give it a try.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
Worth considering.
I didn't notice any problem on my stereo speakers. So maybe that is the case. So it's with Dolby that's the problem. Yeah.
Yeah. Over the weekend, I posted an update to the patient gang who's been waiting to test and pound on the next release of what I really do.
And they responded back, apparently.
Who will be pounding on the next release of what will become, as we know, SpinRite version 6.1. I explained that I had reached the point where, as far as I can tell, everything is working. I tracked down a problem with the non-DMA IDE driver, and I made the BIOS associator a bit more bulletproof. I had previously invested a bunch of time updating SpinRite's original benchmarking code for 16 bits worth of sectors. That is, it used to be able to do 32 bits. Was that, you know, no drives back in 2004 were even close to 32 bits worth of sectors. Of course, we know that what is that, 2.3 terabytes, and drives are bigger than that now. So we added another 32. Actually, we added another 16 bits. So they're 48 bits. But I figured, well, I'm doing 48. Let's get ahead of the curve for a change. I'll do 64. But really, that'll take care of us for a long time, and literally until the aliens have come and gone. But I hate the way the benchmark is working, and I've decided to scrap it and rework it now, since I can't live with it. The trouble is that the only timing reference the original SpinRite had was the PC's counter timer, which is a 16-bit counter timer that runs at 1.193 megahertz, which is one count every 838 nanoseconds. The counter timer is still there, and that's plenty of resolution. But the counter timer chip was a ripple counter, which could sometimes be sampled and caught mid-count or mid-ripple, which would produce a false count result. The chip did have a latching function, but I encountered some that still produced bogus results. So I developed a sanity filter that would take three successive readings from the counter, and SpinRite would only believe the final one if each of the previous two readings showed the same count or one that was increasing. And the filter also had to be smart about the 16-bit counter's wraparound, since that happened 18.2 times per second. If the filter thought that it had obtained a mid-count reading, it would just start over. The point is that back then, that's all I had. So that's what I had to use. Today's RDTSC, which is the read timestamp counter instruction, did not exist as it does now. My new code, the code I've already written for the read speed benchmark, uses the RDTSC instruction for various delays it needs when waiting for hardware to settle, you know, like down in the nanoseconds range for hardware to settle, and for all of its benchmark performance measurements. But SpinWrite had not been using it for the benchmark timing since I was trying to minimize the rewriting. And I figured that what SpinWrite was already doing was fine. But I had to go back into that old code to make sure it would work. And I saw just how horrendous it was. So I need to rip it out and replace it with the newer code that I have already developed for the read speed benchmark. Although it doesn't technically need it, SpinWrite will be needing the new system's insane picosecond resolution in the future, and 6.1's code will be, you know, surviving for years. So now is the time. I've already worked out all the details for read speed, and I have all the formatting and everything ready to go. So it's just a matter of removing the old bad code and moving the newly written good code over. Once that done, I'll be glad that I did. And I will be, that will be release 4 of the pre-release of SpinWrite, which the gang will pound on while I'm working on the finishing up the rewrites of the data recovery portion. And then it's going to be ready for use. So we're getting there.
Excellent. Excellent. Well done. I can't wait. And it just shows, you know, you don't settle. You just don't settle.
I try to, but I...
You can't. Your name's on it. It's going to reflect you. And given how long... How long ago did 2000... Did the System 6 come out? SpinWrite 6?
04.
17. Yeah. So given that this is six... It's going to be like another while. You don't want it to be not perfect, right? Get it. Make it...
I want it to be...
17
although,
years. Wow.
The truth is, because we are connected now the way we weren't then, you know, back then I was arguing with Egghead about why they were returning boxes
right.
SpinWrite that were perfectly fine. It's like, well, we have a return policy that lets anyone return anything they want at any time. I said, well, you realize that they bought it, they took it home, they fixed their hard drive, and they brought it back to you. And now, and you've sent it back to me. Anyway, the point is I'm much happier with the way the world is today, 17 years later, and Egghead is gone, and sorry.
How much, by the way, out of curiosity, how much of the retail price did Egghead keep? 50%?
I think they got 30 because they didn't buy direct. They had to buy through SoftSell, and SoftSell got 50 plus marketing. Oh, excuse me. Did I just say that?
let your feelings out, Steve. It's good for you. You don't want to.
Leo, it was so frustrating working through distribution because we would send the stuff off. Remember we had like bound manuals with spiral binding.
It was expensive. Yeah.
Both the 5 1/4 and the 3.5-inch disc sizes and a registration card, this whole beautiful box, all color printed. They'd go off in big shipments, and then like half of them would come back damaged. They looked like elephants had trodden on them. You know? So of course, so they would deduct that. And then it was supposed to be net 60, and I had two people working full time just to get us paid
yeah.
through through first it was Soft Cell and then Ingram Micro. We had a couple of the big distributors that were doing all of that. And so I'd be end up waiting half a year to get my money, which, you know, meanwhile, they had the product. The customers had it. Everyone loved it, but I wasn't getting paid. So I remember just swearing to myself, the instant I can cut these people out of this, I will. And, you know, thank God for the internet, because it's allowed me to work directly with my end user customers, and things are much better.
The reason I ask is when people complain about Apple's 30%, that's nothing compared to the 50% taken by the distributor, Soft Cell or Ingram or whoever that was. And then you only get 70% of the 50%. And that's minus marketing, you know, before the, you know.
So I did not have a zero cost either.
Right.
You know, and with everything being an electronic download, the publisher really, it's like, oh, well, you know, they're complaining that they're losing 30%, but they have zero cost.
Right. No download cost, no manual cost.
And duplicating diskettes and stuffing all this and shrink wrapping everything. And
you maybe, if you were lucky, took 10-20% of the selling price as profit. I mean, 70% is pretty damn good. I mean, compared to what it was back in the day.
Yeah.
All right. Take a little break. When we come back, we will look at the Facebook people came just joining us saying, did he talk about Facebook yet? No, he didn't. It's coming up next. Steve Gibson.
Because, you know, Leo, something went wrong.
I hear that.
Yeah.
That's the name of our show.
Not good.
Our show today brought to you by IT Pro TV. Yes, October is Cybersecurity Month. Yay! This is my favorite month of the year. I wonder if it has anything to do with Halloween. Like, it's going to be so scary at the end of the month. You better prepare for it. Look, cybersecurity is one of the most important parts of IT. If you listen to this show, I don't have to tell you that. The tech world has lots of jobs open right now, more than 1 million for qualified cybersecurity experts. Where do you learn that? Even if you're already in IT, IT Pro TV. Start or build your IT career today at IT Pro TV. You can learn IT. You can get certified for any number of IT skills. And man, the stuff at IT Pro TV is up to date. They have seven studios operating full time, Monday through Friday, 5,800 hours of IT training on demand. New stuff gets there within 24 hours. Whenever the tests change, the questions change, the versions change, or new certs come out. Microsoft just said, we're killing MCSE, but we've got a whole bunch of new certs. IT Pro's on it. They are on it. And I love them. It's a spooky month at IT Pro TV for October. The month is jam-packed with events focused on cybersecurity. Check out their webinar coming up day after tomorrow on the 7th, Protecting Against Mobile Security Threats in a BYOD Environment. I know a lot of you are interested in that. That's a big issue. You can watch live, but it will be they'll be available for on-demand later. 10/28, at the end of the month, they're going to be in costume, I think. They say it's a Halloween-themed CyberSec incident response for small businesses. The subtitle is Avoiding the Nightmare on Main Street. I love that. For more information on the webinars, itpro.tv/webinars. And if you can be there live, do, because there's, you know, you can ask questions and so forth. itpro.tv/webinars. A week from, what is that, Thursday, October 14th at 5 p.m. Eastern, they're going to do a panel, Dirty Little Secrets of a Cybersecurity Career. If you wanted to know, like, what's behind the scenes, really, what's it like to work in cybersecurity, this would be a great thing. Three IT security pros. Don Pezette will moderate. He's one of the founders of IT Pro TV. He does their TechNATO podcast. He's great. There'll be more information about this on the IT Pro TV YouTube channel. In fact, if you're not subscribing to that, that's a first step right now. And then, to top it off, there's a free weekend, October 23rd and 24th. And as a special for this month's theme, these will be the courses part of the IT Pro TV free membership. CompTIA Security Plus. They're the official video training partner for CompTIA, so they have great CompTIA courses. CompTIA Security Plus, the CEH, the Certified Ethical Hacker cert. I love this. I want this bad. CompTIA's CISA, is that how you pronounce it? C-Y-S-A Plus, and CISSP, CISPA. IT Pro TV's edutainers, that's what they call them, edutainers, make learning IT interesting and fun. They're all, you know, professionals in the field with real expertise, but they're also chosen for their ability to communicate. They're on staff. They're there so you can ask questions. They're constantly up to date. They divide these courses up into 20 to 30 minute chunks, very easy to consume, because they know a lot of you are, you know, have day jobs you hate or night jobs you hate, are taking these classes so you can get a job you love. And maybe you only got little chunks of time here and there. That's fine. They understand. It's all set up for you. And you can learn anywhere. They have a Roku app, a Apple TV app. You can Chromecast it. I mean, it's really, really nice. The IT world definitely needs cybersecurity professionals more than ever. If you listen to the show, I think you know that. Get your cybersecurity cert with IT Pro TV. Visit itpro.tv. I hear Facebook's hiring. Is that you think? I bet there are a few openings there today. itpro.tv/securitynow. You'll get, by the way, this is a great deal, 30% off any consumer subscription. That's like almost a third off, 30% off, code SN30. And that's forever. As long as you stay active, it continues. So you, and many people do stay at IT Pro TV for years because it's a great community. Great place to learn, great place to get more skills so you get a better job. I think you're going to love it. 30% off. Here's the offer code SN30. IT Pro TV. Build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. itpro.tv/securitynow. Thank you so much for supporting Steve's very important efforts to make the world a safer place. itpro.tv/securitynow. Facebook. Sorry, something went wrong.
Something went wrong. I love the screen that came up because it says, we're working on it. Well, first it says, sorry, something went wrong. We're working on it and we'll get it fixed as soon as we can. And then there's a link, go back. So like,
was the image broken too? That's the other thing I love. Yes, something went wrong. We couldn't even give you an image. Sorry, we don't even have that.
Know what that. I would love to know what that was of, but you can't see it now. And I love it then because then, of course, they added their copyright. Facebook copyright 2020.
Oh, is, you know, whoops.
Yes.
They couldn't even update this. They were so out of luck.
Yeah. Ugh. Okay, so the internet's big iron routers are connected to each other by their peering interface links. For example, if you had a piece of paper covered with a bunch of circles representing routers, then drew straight lines between each of the circles close to other circles, those straight lines linking circles would be peering links. Those peering links carry the low-level packet traffic which routers route, and the routers also use those same links to maintain persistent TCP connections over which the BGP protocol flows. BGP, the Border Gateway Protocol, is a TCP-hosted protocol like HTTP, FTP, SMTP. But in this case, BGP is a peering protocol exclusively used by routers to talk to each other, specifically to talk to their immediately adjacent connected neighbors. The conversation they have has the purpose of synchronizing their respective routing tables with each other, with the routers to which they peer, which is to say, to which they are directly connected. When a router receives a change to its own routing table, either introduced by a local admin or received from another router peer, it updates its own table appropriately to reflect the changes, then sends news of those changes, which it has just made to its table, to its other peers, so that they too might make any needed adjustments. Now, a large enterprise, which has its own autonomous system number, AS, as it's called, Facebook's AS is 32934, will use their large backbone routers to connect their public enterprise network to the rest of the public internet. Their routers will know which IP ranges belong to its enterprise owner and will contain entries in its routing table to route traffic bound for those IP ranges to the enterprise's router interfaces. And since every such router shares its routing table with its peers over BGP, all of its peering routers will also know that any traffic they receive for those IPs should be forwarded to that autonomous system router. And since those routers also share their routing tables with their peers, all of the routers they connect to will also know, and so it goes, over and over, peer by peer, until every big router on the internet knows where to send traffic that's bound for any of that enterprise's IP ranges. In the weird parlance of BGP routing, we say that that the original router is advertising the routes which it alone is able to handle by forwarding any incoming traffic to its internet-connected enterprise. So it advertises the routes for the traffic it should receive. So yesterday, at 11:39 a.m. Eastern Time, shortly before noon, 15:39 UTC, someone at Facebook updated the routing information for Facebook's networks to something that no longer worked. Even now, following Facebook's official post-recovery blog posting, they're not telling the world exactly what happened. Initial reports suggested that it might only be the routing to Facebook's four authoritative DNS servers, which are A, B, C, and D dot NS, as in name server, A, B, C, and D dot NS dot Facebook.com, that may have been messed up to render those crucial servers unavailable. But some additional evidence suggests that the trouble was much bigger than that. The reports of a DNS-based failure came from those whose own DNS servers suddenly started returning serve fail errors, indicating that none of those four authoritative Facebook DNS servers responsible for Facebook.com were replying to their queries. Presumably, those four authoritative Facebook DNS servers were still up, but they had just become unreachable due to a routing error. The reason I believed that DNS was only part of a much bigger, probably network-wide, all of Facebook problem was that, as shown in the diagram I have in the show notes, traffic being served by Facebook dropped like a rock off a cliff. And in the show notes, I have this chart which shows the moment this happened and traffic just collapsed. It went from, you know, near its peak around noon on the East Coast, which, because there is sort of a sinusoidal traffic pattern that we see from domestic-based companies, it just, over the course of about 5 minutes, just went to zero. So, as we know, DNS caches. And caching is a core feature of DNS. If this were just, and I have that in air quotes, a major DNS outage, we would expect to see a far more gradual reduction in traffic to Facebook over a span of hours rather than minutes, as the internet's massively dispersed and distributed DNS caches, which exist at every level, even right down to the individual end user smartphone and desktop PC, as those individual cache entries independently expired, their own local DNS would only then go in search of an IP address to update. And only when an expired entry could not be updated would the user's local machine report that Facebook had become unavailable. Or, as their copyrighted page wonderfully stated, something went wrong. Yesterday, during the outage, just like the rest of the world, I was unable to query Facebook's authoritative DNS servers. So I was unable to obtain the details of how Facebook had set up their DNS. But this morning, with Facebook back on the air, we can more closely examine the way they have their DNS configured. I used NSLookup to pull the SOA, which is the Start of Authority DNS record, directly from one of Facebook's authoritative DNS servers, a.ns.facebook.com. Here's what I received. In the show notes, I have a picture of the output of NSLookup, which I had configured to do a query type of SOA, and I queried facebook.com using the server a.ns.facebook.com. And what we get back is both an IPv6 and an IPv4 address, and then the Start of Authority record, which shows the serial number for that record, the refresh interval in seconds, which is 14,400, which is 4 hours, the retry interval, 1,800, which is 30 minutes, the expiration, which has 604,800 seconds, in other words, 7 days, and the default TTL, the time to live for this record, which is 300 seconds or 5 minutes. The last two items there tell the story, the record expiration time and the default TTL. Facebook's default TTL for their DNS records is only 5 minutes.
That's pretty short, right?
That's very short.
Yeah.
This means that unless it's been overridden by a per record TTL and Facebook's A and Quad A records for its IPv4 and IPv6 IPs are not overridden, that means that once every 5 minutes, every DNS client on the planet will see that its local cached copy of Facebook's IP address has reached its end of life and should start and should be refetched from that client's configured DNS server. But if that update query fails, what happens? That's where the SOA's specified record expiration time keeps you from being SOL. Although Facebook uses a short TTL, they also use an expiration of 7 days. And that will be 7 days from the most recent previous successful update, which would have been within the past 5 minutes. This means that even if Facebook's DNS had dropped off the face of the earth, so long as the rest of Facebook was still present, clients on the planet would have happily continued using Facebook for the next week while their DNS patiently and periodically attempted to check in for a DNS update. I figured that they have such a short TTL as part of their load balancing because the servers are able to decide which IPs they want to give out. Typically, they have, huge banks of IPs. And by by asking clients to come back to the trough for another IP every 5 minutes. That allows Facebook to dynamically decide which IPs they want to send where. But again, in the event that there's no IP available, all the clients have been told you can keep using what you have for a week. So, in other words, all of the evidence points to this being a massive whole of Facebook internet outage, an internet routing error. Add to that the fact that Facebook's Instagram service also disappeared from the internet, despite the fact that Instagram's DNS is hosted by Amazon, not Facebook, and Amazon didn't have a problem. So this wasn't about just DNS. As we know, DNS caches, but what doesn't cache is BGP. If someone at Facebook made the colossal mistake of deleting all of Facebook's routes from the internet, that change would have propagated at the speed of the internet. And within a few minutes, just as we saw from that sheer internet traffic cliff, no internet backbone routers anywhere in the world would have had any idea what to do with a Facebook IP address, even though all of those users would have still had them cached for the next week. Since BGP is just a protocol like any other, anyone with access to autonomous system level routers, which peer with each other, or is on the inside of inter-network operations, can monitor BGP traffic and activity directly. Excuse me. And Monday afternoon, Cloudflare was doing just that. In the show notes again, I have a strip, a diagram. The chart shows a 30-minute graph taken from 1530 to 1600 UTC of Facebook-related BGP traffic. Normally, there's nothing happening since routing tends to be boring, except when it's not. And there was nothing boring about routing yesterday. The chart shows that starting at exactly 1539 in the darker blue trace, some new routes were announced. And a bit later, there was a similar volume of routes withdrawn. That's in the lighter blue. It may have been that was deliberate because it looks like things were being moved around. But then, about a minute and a half later, we see a massive flurry of routes being withdrawn in the lighter blue, where the area under the curve dwarfs that of any new replacement announcements. Now, maybe it was supposed to be that way. The goal may have been to consolidate routes, which is much better for routing efficiency. In that case, you would expect to see many more withdrawals than new announcements to replace them. Except that we also know that the result of this sudden flurry of activity was a catastrophe. So it really looks like a mistake.
There's actually a secondary post, which I don't want to interrupt your flow, but at the end, Facebook has posted a much more detail about what happened. We now know what happened, but I'll go ahead because I want you to speculate and then you'll see. You're actually pretty right on.
So, and as I wrote here, by now, Facebook certainly knows precisely what happened, but based upon their public statement, once this had all been resolved, it doesn't appear as though we're going to get much clarity from them unless it eventually leaks out. But what they did say confirms our hypothesis from the evidence. So what they posted first is they wrote, "To all the people and businesses around the world who depend upon us, We are sorry for the inconvenience caused by today's outage across our platforms. We've been working as hard as we can to restore access, and our systems are now back up and running. The underlying cause of this outage also impacted many of the internal tools and systems we use in our day-to-day operations, complicating our attempts to quickly diagnose and resolve the problem. Our engineering teams have learned that configuration changes on the backbone routers that coordinate network traffic between our data centers caused issues that interrupted this communication. This disruption to network traffic had a cascading effect on the way our data centers communicate, bringing our services to a halt. Now, of course, that's a very generic way of saying what we've just talked about. They said our services are now back online and we're actively working to fully return them to regular operations. We want to make clear at this time, we believe the root cause of this outage was a faulty configuration change. We also have no evidence that user data was compromised as a result of this downtime, blah, 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 and we apologize and so forth. Okay, so what was most curious and really sort of unbelievable while this was all happening was that Facebook didn't quickly pop back up on the air. When I learned that they were down, I was thinking, okay, you know, this won't take long. You know, if someone had entered a bad routing update, how difficult could it be to at least roll back the change? As it happens, while this was going on, I was already at work on this podcast, so I was able to participate in the drama with my followers on Twitter. My first tweet read, "Facebook may have deplatformed itself along with Instagram and WhatsApp. Hope no one depends upon login with Facebook." Whoopsie. Somehow, the BGP entries for Facebook's DNS resolvers have been withdrawn from the internet's routing tables. Insider? Attack? Who knows? Wow. After a bit more digging, I added, someone on Facebook, on the Facebook recovery effort, has explained that a routine BGP update went wrong, which in turn locked out those with remote access who could reverse the mistake. Those who do have physical access do not have authorization on the servers. Catch 22. So I said, so we were beginning to get some clarification at that point of the trouble. And apparently, the unexpected loss of internet routing had cut off their own engineers from the routers they needed to access in order to roll back the changes. Again, whoopsie. Now, I know this is actually a very real concern. I manage GRC's network at level 3 remotely, and I sometimes need to alter the operation of the equipment that manages GRC's border with the internet. My own management traffic is crossing that same boundary as the one I'm managing, and I want my own management traffic to be crossing that same boundary since it's a security boundary and my management traffic needs to be highly secured. But that also means that I need to be very careful not to edit some rule that locks me out. And it has happened, which necessitated a drive over to the physical plant to log on to the machine directly and correct a mistake. During all this, a New York Times reporter tweeted, was just on the phone with someone who works for Facebook who described employees unable to enter buildings this morning to begin to evaluate extent of outage because their badges weren't working to access doors. So apparently, everything at Facebook is IoT, baby, on the internet and dependent upon some super secure access control server somewhere else, which cannot be reached during the routing outage. After some additional digging, my next tweet was, reports are that Facebook employees cannot enter their headquarters because their badges don't work, and those inside are unable to enter various rooms because access is dependent upon obtaining authorization from remote Facebook authentication servers. Those who live by technology, dot, dot, dot. And in light of all the recent news about Facebook, Facebook's internal awareness that an obsession with Instagram postings may not be good for many of the youngsters who have flocked to it, I added a tongue-in-cheek tweet. Meanwhile, there's been a noted global decrease in reports of teenage depression and poor self-image. Mental health is on the rise, but fear not. BGP is sure to be restored soon. And finally, to top it all off, 5.5 years ago, back in April of 2016, Facebook acquired the domain registrar, registrarsec.com. Ever since then, they've been their own domain registrar because why not? But what happens when Facebook's own domain registrar goes offline due to a routing outage? Thanks to the automated systems being used by some less clued-in registrars, which are continually searching the internet for previously registered domains which appear to be expired, abandoned, or recently vacated, yesterday, and I kid you not, several different registrars were listing the domain Facebook.com as being available for sale. I grabbed a screenshot of one of those several for the show notes. It announced with an exclamation point that Facebook.com is for sale.
Wow.
Something went wrong indeed.
Probably those are automated systems that monitor for this kind of thing, sniping.
Yep.
These things. So Facebook today published more details about the outage.
Good.
And I think this is actually what sounds very credible as to what happened. This is from Santosh Jagannathan. Now that our platforms are up and running as usual after yesterday's outage, I thought it would be worth sharing a little more detail on what happened and why, and most importantly, how we're learning for it. The outage was triggered by a system that manages, and you were right, it's load balancing our global backbone network capacity. Now he does a lot of explanation about how DNS works and stuff, so I'll skip over that. I think we all know that. So when you want to open one of our apps, the app's request for data travels to the nearest data center, which then communicates directly over our backbone network to a larger data center. The data traffic between all these facilities is managed by routers, of course. In the extensive day-to-day work of maintaining this infrastructure, our engineers often need to take part of the backbone offline for maintenance, perhaps to repair a fiber line, add more capacity, etc., or updating the software in the router itself. This was the source of yesterday's outage. During one of these routine maintenance jobs, a command was issued with the intention to assess the availability of global backbone capacity. And you can probably understand better between the lines what kind of command that was. It unintentionally took down all the connections in our backbone network, effectively disconnecting Facebook data centers globally. They took down their own backbone. Our systems are designed to audit commands like these to prevent mistakes like this. I would hope so.
What? Yes.
But a bug in that audit tool, a bug, prevented it from properly stopping the command. So this change caused a complete disconnection of our server connections between our data centers and the internet. And then that caused a second issue. This is the thing you saw and everybody else saw that made things worse. One of the jobs performed by our smaller facilities is to respond to DNS queries. This is interesting too. To ensure reliable operation, our DNS servers disable BGP advertisements if they themselves cannot speak to the data centers, since this is an indication of an unhealthy network connection. Because the backbone was removed from the operation, these locations declared themselves unhealthy and withdrew the BGP advertisements. So they stopped saying, we're here, we're routing. The end result was our DNS servers became unreachable, even though they were still operational. And then, well, you saw the consequence. And, of course, the reason it took so long, our engineers worked to figure out what was happening and why they faced two large obstacles. First, it was not possible to access our data centers through normal means because the networks were down. And second, the loss of DNS broke many of the internal tools we'd normally use to investigate and resolve outages like this. So we sent engineers on site, but obviously these facilities are highly secure, hard to get into, and even once you get into them, the hardware and routers are designed to be difficult to modify even if you have physical access to them. So,
in other words, they're heavily protected.
As they should be, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So they were even protected from themselves. They were on remediation efforts. So it's you got to read between the lines of what exactly.
Yeah, he's putting a little more weight on DNS outage than I think is proper. As we saw, clients will wait a week before they get upset.
Yeah.
So
once the backbone is down, you don't have any connection back to the home office. You
just, yes. It was the fact that their routes got pulled. You know, whatever this thing was. I mean, Lord knows what kind of command would have like.
Well, it sounded like a diagnostic.
We're still not having the detail that you know that would satisfy.
Yeah, what tool?
Any
what's the name of the tool
engineer.
And all that? They may or may not reveal that. You know, again, for security reasons.
I don't. They have no obligation to. Yeah. You know, they're like, whoops, we're sorry. Everything's good. Move along.
So there were two problems. One that, you know, they were testing the reliability of the backbone and inadvertently issued a command that they brought the backbone down. And then the tool that was to protect
that. That made the reliability test really easy.
It's off.
Zero.
But the tool that was to protect from, you know, this kind. And this is always my question when you get BGP routing tables screwed up is, you know, wouldn't you test that? Wouldn't you have some software that could, and we even advertise software that will, you know, assess the change and see what will happen without actually implementing it. Apparently they had a tool like that that had a bug and failed. So it's interesting.
Yeah. It's still murky enough.
There's more.
More
to this story. Yeah. But it kind of makes sense. And you could see how it's a cascade of failures. We knew that must be, right? It was a normal maintenance procedure that went wrong. You can imagine though, the engineer that pushed that test out and then all of a sudden, all routes, the backbones bones are down. Oh my God. The freak out that must've been.
Yeah.
Somebody's saying, well, they had a thing that said, are you sure you want to run this command? Y or N?
Are you really, really sure?
This could delete all the routes. Are you sure? Our engineers often need to take part of the backbone offline for maintenance. This was the source of yesterday's outage. A command was issued with the intention to assess the availability of global backbone capacity.
Yeah.
What could that be?
Yeah, I mean, for example, if you were to unroute a network segment, then you might run traffic through it in order to check that network segment.
Yeah.
So you would have traffic going across the segment while you were using it, you know, while it was under test. So that would mean that you would put in some commands to route around that segment that was down for testing. And, you know, he put in a *** when he didn't intend to.
I do know that there are now three openings that's on the same post for software engineer routing and data path.
And the fact is with Facebook being as big as they are,
they have
to be a little obtuse when they, I mean, for security reasons, yeah. they can't really tell us what it was, because if they gave us a recipe for taking Facebook off the air, then, you know, that's information that nobody should have.
Yeah, so nobody needs to know those tools. Many of them are probably custom-built inside Facebook.
Actually, Facebook built their own entire stack.
That's
all
right.
All of their software, all of their network software is from scratch.
Right, as is their hardware. I mean, they created their own little, you know, modules and everything. The thing that always blows my mind, whether it's Facebook or Google or Microsoft, 20, 30 years ago, we would never have contemplated the notion that there may be a network operation that serves 3 billion people daily.
I know.
Mind-boggling. And to go from 0 to 60 over a decade, it's kind of incomprehensible. So the fact that it works at all is frankly as reliable as it is normally is kind of impressive. When you go to Facebook, it pops up. Those images load almost instantly. It's amazing.
And I feel the same way about the human body. You know, someone says, something's broken, doesn't work. I said, it's amazing. It works at all. Well, are you kidding me?
Actually, and I've been meaning to tell you, given you're Mr. Quantified Self, I'm sure aware of the fact you can do these full body MRIs. Lisa and I recently did this from a company Kevin Rose had recommended to us. They're out of British Columbia called Prenuvo. Are you familiar with Prenuvo? Have you heard
I heard you talk about it.
Oh, you heard us talk about it.
I immediately jumped online to see, and unfortunately, the closest one is Silicon Valley.
I was saying, next time you come up to Redwood City, let us know. And, you know, it's expensive. And this is there are two negatives to this. One is $2,500. And they take, by the way, it's an hour procedure because they take many more pictures than a normal MRI would. They're getting, you know, exposures from every angle and in many different ways. So it's expensive and it's a long procedure. The other downside to it, which doctors are always bringing up, is the human body is not perfect. We know that on the outside we're not perfect. Well, you're not perfect on the inside either. And you're going to find out about all sorts of things you didn't know. And probably most of those you'd live your entire life without knowing or caring. And it wouldn't make any difference. And the trick with this is to know, well, that's something that's actionable. Or that's just, you know, you're not perfect. I have apparently an atrophied kidney. Could have been congenital. I will never know because this is the first time I've done this.
Right.
And you guess why you have two, right? And there's no blood test or anything that's shown any problems. Should I be concerned about it? Well, I am kind of. I mean, that's not a good thing. But on the other hand, it probably has been there my whole life, and who knows and who cares, right?
Well, what I like about that is that being an MRI rather than a CAT scan,
it's safe.
It's non-radiation, so you're not increasing your radiation load.
Yeah.
So that it has that going for it. And, you know, frankly, if there was one in my neighborhood, I'd seriously consider it, and I would keep Lori away from it because –
You mean scan? You wouldn't want her to see your scan.
She worries about whether the sun is going to come up in the morning.
I know.
And it's like, that would not be a good. Well, that would not be a good thing.
Lisa and I are very glad we did it. I won't go into the details. I've already shared too much, but we're glad we did it, and we will now. Now that we have a baseline, I think we will do it every 18 months. Because now you know. I wish I'd done this when I was 25, because then I would know. Well, this is where you're starting, and the changes you want to look for. So. I think it's very interesting, and I know you're Mr. Quantified Self, so you should do it.
In fact, I do carotid ultrasounds every couple of years.
That's right. I remember that. Yeah.
Yes.
Same
because
reason.
It's a very good proxy for your cardiac arteries, and so if you see excessive plaque building up, it's a clue to, you know, not wait until a piece of it flakes off or a major artery clogs all the way.
I'm happy to say, and I don't know if this would do as well as that, but no heart disease, no cancer. So, that's important. I'm glad that's the main reason I did it.
I think that's very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someday I'll show you my pictures. Steve Gibson is at grc.com. That is the place to get his unique versions of this show. He has a 16 kilobit audio version, which sounds like Thomas Edison recorded it in his lab, but it is small. That's the
800.
Mary had a little lamb. But it's small, and that's the reason we do that. So those of you who have limited bandwidth or metered bandwidth, that's a good way to get the audio. He also has a transcript, which is even smaller. That's really, really great. You can read along as you listen or use it to search for parts of the show. It's on Google, so it's indexed. So that's really great. Elaine Ferris writes those for us. He also has 64 kilobit audio. All of this is at grc.com. And while you're there, by all means, this is a good time to pick up a copy of the world's best mass storage recovery and maintenance utility, SpinRite. Currently 6.0. 6.1 is, as you heard, in very active development. You'll get to participate in that, and you'll get a copy of 6.1 automatically for free if you buy 6.0 now. So grc.com. Lots of other great free resources there, including his DNS benchmark, which I used the other day to figure out who I should use for DNS, that kind of thing. We have copies of the show at our website, twit.tv/SN. There's a YouTube channel. You can go there. We have video there and on our site. And, of course, you can subscribe. In fact, I encourage you to subscribe in your favorite podcast client. That way you don't even think about it. You just have it whenever you're in the mood to listen. If your client does allow reviews, please leave us a 5-star review just so others know about this really phenomenal resource. Steve will be the guest of an AMA on Friday as part of our Club Twit. I'm very excited about this. This was brilliant. Ant Pruitt, who is now our community manager, we said, Ant, we really want to grow the club. He said, I'm going to help. And we're going to bring in Steve because I know people want to ask him questions. So yeah, I'm surprised. I thought I didn't think you'd do that. That's good.
I'll support the club.
If you're a member of Club Twit, be in the Discord. It's there all the time, but that will be a good time. There'll be a Twit Plus feed where you can listen to that after the fact as well. And Club Twit members also get ad-free versions of everything we do. Twit.tv/ClubTwit, $7 a month. And don't tell anybody, especially don't tell Lisa. But if you just want to hear the Steve AMA, $7, you cancel right away. You get a month ad-free all through October, and you'll get to hear Steve. It's month-to-month. There's no long-term sign-up, so it'd be nice if you stuck around because it supports us. We do this show every Tuesday right after Mac Break Weekly, usually between 1:30 and 2 p.m. Pacific. That's 4:30 and 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 20:30 UTC. The live streams are at twit.tv/live. There's audio and video there. The chat room is irc.twit.tv. The Discord is also open for chat during all of our shows. And we even have forums. The Twit community is at twit.community. And the Mastodon instance, our social kind of Twitter alike, our Fediverse is at twit.social. Twit.community, twit.social. You're welcome to join up there. Those are free as well. Steve, have a great week. I'll be watching in The Invasion 2. Crossing my fingers.
Yes.
We'll see you next time on Security Now.
Okay, buddy. Bye.
Have you ever read a tech news story and thought to yourself, man, I would love to talk to the person who wrote this to find out more information? Well, that's exactly what Micah Sargent and I, Jason Howell, do each and every week on Tech News Weekly. We read the stories that matter to us, we reach out to the people making a break in the tech news, and we invite them on to tell their story. And you can find it at twit.tv. Look for Tech News Weekly every Thursday. Security Now.